From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Edward R. Murrow launched a radio series called This I Believe in 1951, featuring men and women reading personal essays about the principles that have guided their lives. A new version of the series has been airing on NPR. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the co-creator of the revived version, Jay Allison, and we'll listen back to Murrow reading his essay that launched the original series. Allison has co-edited a new This I Believe book. Also, we talk with the British film director Stephen Frears about his new film, The Queen, set in the week after the death of Princess Diana. Frears' other films include My Beautiful Laundrette, The Grifters, High Fidelity, and Dirty Pretty Things. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with the new website at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Edward R. Murrow launched a radio series in 1951 called This I Believe. Each installment featured someone, often someone famous, reading a personal essay about the guiding principles of his or her life. This I Believe was recently revived and airs regularly on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. My guest Jay Allison hosts the series and co-created it with Dan Gediman. They've also just edited a book and a collection of companion CDs called This I Believe that feature essays from the new series along with ones from the original series. Allison is considered one of the most important independent producers in the history of public radio, and he's won all the big awards, including 5 Peabodys. He lives in Cape Cod and founded 3 radio stations to serve the area. He also founded Transom.org, a website that serves as a showcase for audio pieces and a forum for radio producers. It was the first website to win a Peabody. Let's start with Edward R. Murrow's essay that launched This I Believe in 1951.
We hardly need to be reminded that we are living in an age of confusion. A lot of us have traded in our beliefs for bitterness and cynicism, or for a heavy package of despair, or even a quivering portion of hysteria. Around us all, now high like a distant thunderhead, now close upon us with the wet, choking intimacy of a London fog, there is an enveloping cloud of fear. There is a physical fear, the kind that drives some of us to flee our homes and burrow into the ground in the bottom of a Montana valley, like prairie dogs, to try to escape, if only for a little while, the sound and the fury of the A-bombs or the hell bombs or whatever may be coming.
That's Edward Murrow introducing the original series, This I Believe. Jay Allison, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi, Terry.
No, Murrow talks in his commentary about us living in an age of fear and confusion. Do you feel like we are still in that kind of age?
Well, don't you? Yes, I do. And I think we're afraid of each other. And we are certainly afraid of the other. And partly because we don't understand them. And I think there's something so disarming about hearing someone and hearing them on the radio, and they sneak past your defenses and you can't help sense them as human beings. You know, we don't have ear lids, I always say, and it leaves us a little bit vulnerable to ambush by the emotion that's contained in another person's voice.
Your new book and the CDs that come with it bring together new essays written for your version of This, I Believe, and combine that with some of the essays recorded for the original 1950s series. And since the new essays are airing a lot on NPR, I thought we'd go back and listen to another one from the 1950s. And this one features Margaret Sanger, who founded the first birth control clinic in the United States in 1916 and founded the American Birth Control League, which later became Planned Parenthood. And this is her talking a little bit about working, you know, fighting for the availability of contraception. Do you want to say anything about this, Jay, before we hear it?
Her essay, it begins in a way that is resonant with a lot of the essays that are written for us now. And they are about belief forged in hardship and tested by difficulty and in proximity to death and illness, which are the times when life becomes most precious and you maybe think most deeply about it. So many of our essays come as a result of an experience with illness, particularly cancer these days. But Margaret Sanger begins her essay saying, "All our basic convictions must be tested and transmuted in the crucible of experience. And sometimes the more bitter the experience, the more valid the purified belief."
Well, I don't think I ever heard Margaret Sanger's voice before hearing this commentary. So why don't we hear it? This is from the 1950s version of This, I Believe.
As a nurse, I was in contact with the ill and the infirm. I knew something about the health and disease of bodies. But for a long time, I was baffled at the tremendous personal problems of life, of marriage, of living, and just of being. Here, indeed, was a challenge to build beyond thyself. I believed it was my duty to place motherhood on a higher level than enslavement and accident. For these beliefs, I was denounced, arrested. I was in and out of police courts and higher courts, and indictments hung over my life for several years. But nothing could alter my beliefs, because I saw these as truths, and I stubbornly stuck to my convictions.
That's Margaret Sanger, as recorded in the early 1950s for the radio series This I Believe. Jay Allison produces the new version of This I Believe, which has been running on NPR programs, and now he's edited a book and CD collection of new and old This I Believe essays. You've done a lot of reports over the years for NPR and also for Nightline, but you've also done a lot over the years facilitating other people to tell their stories and to make their programs. And I guess I'm wondering why you've wanted to spend so much time facilitating other people's ability to use the audio medium to do their work and to tell their stories.
Payback. I was an aimless youth and wandering through Washington at the time that public radio, National Public Radio, particularly began. And a guy there, Keith Talbot, the same person who got my friend Ira Glass into radio, loaned me a tape recorder, a little reel-to-reel machine, and said, "Hey, look, we're just looking for interesting stuff." And you know, I'd been a theater director, and I was really at loose ends, and this tape recorder organized my life. I felt like it gave me permission to go out and find out about things I didn't know about and people I didn't know about, and then take maybe those theatrical skills and put them to use, shaping what they'd told me and try to find out what was essential about it. And it was liberating, and it also seemed as though it was the point of what we should be doing on public radio, which is giving us all a chance to speak and listen. And I love that idea. I love the notion that we could, have and use this precious little space on the radio dial to talk to each other in decent and revealing ways and funny ways and real ways. So I just started every way I could to kind of pass that on, and I do it in all sorts of ways now. I buy tape recorders on eBay and loan them out, and I work with people in telling their stories. I've got websites that are built to help people figure out how to use the gear and get their stuff on the radio, and it's endlessly gratifying and much more interesting than telling my own story over and over again.
So you know, you mentioned one of the things you do now. You have a website called transom.org. In which you showcase the work of new producers and people who aren't producers but just want to work with audio.
Yeah, just people.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about what the purpose of Transom is.
It's kind of a master class and a workshop and an audition stage, and we invite great storytellers to come hold forth for a month at a time. Everyone from people like Norman Corwin and Studs Terkel to Sarah Vowell and Ira Glass, and then people from other media, writers like Rick Moody or filmmakers like Errol Morris, all talking about this kind of documentary work and trying to figure out how to tell about life in an honest and in new ways, too. I think a lot of what we do on public radio tends to sound like what we did yesterday. And Transom's very much dedicated to the idea that we got to figure out how to change the tone, how to change the style. And so we invite people to make their own stories. We give them all the tools. So there are pages and pages and pages there of everything from, you know, what microphone to buy and how to work a digital audio editing system and all that stuff. And then people send us what they made, and we put that on the site. And now we have an hour-long radio broadcast we distribute to stations called the Transom Radio Hour that puts it all together. It puts together the eminent storytellers with the new storytellers. All of it, the idea being to encourage listeners to become participants, to make listeners the content of what we do.
I want to play something that's on the Transom website, and this is by somebody named David Greenberger, who I know you work with for Transom. So before we hear it, tell us something about him and what kind of audio work he's doing.
He's such an interesting guy. He used to work in a nursing home in up around Boston, and he would just talk to the people there, and then bit by bit almost began collaborating with them in a sense conversationally. And they would tell him about their lives, which were rich and surprising. And he would record and then write down what they say. And we've worked a lot. We had him come up to Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, where I live, and we have our radio stations. And he just visit and talk with people. And then he renders them in this amazing way where he becomes almost a lyricist and vocalist and gets bands to back him up as he says their words in a way that makes you hear them. It's a little, it's different from a lot of the work we do, which is really about having the primary speaker tell his own story. David's a kind of a translator, interpreter, and his notion is that you will hear these stories more clearly through his, and I think you do, through the attachment he has and through his memory of the conversation, maybe than you would if it was an old person speaking and your first thought was, this person is old. And so when David's voice says it, it makes you think differently about the content.
Okay, so this is David Greenberger, and you can find this on the transom.org website.
My husband's father was a genius. He had 16 patents in his own name, and he was a brain. But he had no feeling, just all brains. My husband, he did as little as possible. He didn't like to work. I don't remember how long we were married, but it seemed like a long time. He was a lot of fun to start with. He just got a little sober when he got older. Not much fun. And you gotta keep me laughing if you wanna make me happy. Anyway, he died. Gosh, I can't remember when he died.
That's David Greenberger, and that's one of the many pieces that's on the transom.org website, which was created by my guest Jay Allison, and who is also the co-producer of the This I Believe series, and now the This I Believes, old and new, from the Edward R. Murrow days and the new NPR days, are collected in a new book and CD collection. When you started on radio, did people say to you, oh, you have a great radio voice?
No, I don't think I do particularly. I mean, all my early pieces were, I wasn't in them at all. I just, they were just other people. And I did a piece about a tattooist in D.C., and I actually had to put in a line of narration. I was scared to death. I recorded it probably 50 times, just trying to get my voice to relax and this, because, when you talk, then you have to decide who you are and how you sound. And that's very disconcerting, I think, for people. I mean, every time I coach one of these This I Believe essays, I do them all over the phone and people go to studios where they are. And they're so nervous, I think, because it's this idea of who am I? How do I sound? How should I sound? And it's taken me a long time to feel remotely comfortable with it. And, I still don't even. I mean, even sitting here talking to you, the part of my brain is wondering, how do I sound?
When you say you have to figure out who you are before you can start recording, that sounds like a very theater thing to say, but you're not in a role when you're playing yourself.
But we're performing, aren't we? I mean, I think that's something that maybe a lot of the newspaper reporters who now are at public radio need to understand, is that it is a performance medium. We have to keep people's attention. We have to be aware of rhythm and pace and climax and scene setting and all those sorts of values that maybe aren't associated with media that aren't based in time.
Well, you've just put yourself on the paradox of what we often try to do in radio, which is like, be yourself, don't be phony. Be natural, be yourself, but make sure that you're lively and funny and focused. And
I know, it's
you know,
not
so
easy.
It's really hard, and it makes being yourself kind of problematic.
I think sometimes, I use a lot of my old theater director techniques in working with people to get them to do that. And some of it is to find a different point of focus than any of those things and get them to maybe just stand up instead of sitting down, or to have them yell it through one time and then say, okay, good, now just speak it, but just the way you did when you were yelling. And people sometimes find they have to get around themselves. They have to get past themselves to be themselves.
Jay Allison is the co-creator of the revived version of This I Believe and co-editor of the new companion book, This is Fresh Air. We just heard from one of the more influential producers in the history of public radio. The only reason why public radio has survived long enough to have a history is that listeners have cared enough to support it through the years. Your station is fundraising today. Please call with a pledge. Thank you. Let's get back to our interview with public radio producer Jay Allison, co-creator of the series and co-editor of the book, This I Believe. Now, you moved to Cape Cod in 1986, and in 2000 you started a new NPR radio station on the Cape and another NPR radio station in Nantucket, and now there's a third on Martha's Vineyard.
There are three sticks, as we call them. They're three transmitters, but they all come from one place. It's hard to cover that area because there's, you know, so much darn water.
That's right. These are, you know, there's the Cape and then there's the two islands. So was there no easy-to-hear public radio there? I know you could, when the weather was good, draw in the Boston stations.
Yeah, they drifted in, but, you know, Cape Cod and the islands are not Boston, and I felt, I mean, being a public radio lifer for one thing, but also then just a resident of a community, I felt like, oh, this place needs its own public radio station. We need to have our own identity reflected. We need to understand each other better here. And so starting the stations was to do that. And also I wanted to know my neighbors better, and I wanted the radio station to be a way that that maybe that could happen.
Well, you said, you know, you wanted on the local stations to have a sense of place, a sense of the local identity. And one of the ways you've done that is through what you describe as sonic IDs. Tell us what they are.
They're like tiny little portraits or stories that air interstitially through the broadcast day. I mean, most public radio stations now have block programming, even like yours, with all due respect. And it's and there's not much time left to carve out the local identity. And some stations have, a call-in show or other things. But we use the tiny little bits of time in between to try to like a signature for our place. So we go out and we record stories and little portraits and overheard conversations and poems and songs, and we invite the listeners to call in, and they tell us stories. And all of these air in like 30 and 60 second breaks, and they're unheralded. They don't have titles. It's just they just pop out. So you have this sense of parallel existence between the place you live and then the news you're hearing of the world you live in. And if they're good, I think what you do is you look at the radio. And if I'm sitting with someone and they're listening, and then I see them turn to look at the radio when one of these comes on, then I know that it worked.
It's funny, looking at the radio, I know exactly what you mean. I want to play one of the sonic IDs that you did, and it's about scallops clapping. Do these shellfish actually clap? What does that mean?
Well, I need to correct you because they're called scallops up where we come from. But I grew up further south, and I actually went on the air and introduced them as scallops. They clap their shells. You'll hear, but the. But the local scallopers called the radio station and said, look, tell Allison, we don't know where he comes from, but up here we call him scallops. So I had to go back and retract the ID, and now I'm correcting you.
So tell us what we're going to be hearing.
Scallops clapping.
Okay, here it goes.
Listen. Scallops clapping on Martha's Vineyard. You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
I eat scallops, but who knew that they make sounds like that? I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, they after they're caught, they sit there and they kind of gulp.
Oh. And there's another sonic idea I want our listeners to hear, and this will speak for itself.
The worst thing about living on Nantucket for a teenager is probably the boredom.
Stephen Hamblin of Nantucket.
So Jay, how did this bored teenager find his way to the radio station?
Somebody found him. I mean, we have people going out with tape recorders all the time. Like I said, I get old cassette recorders and things off eBay, and we invite our listeners to come borrow them and take them out and record things. And that one was done by an intern and set to music, and the music's just right. But, you know, a lot of the pieces we have are it's kind of an ongoing oral history project in a way, because we'll go out and record people who've been living there for generations, and just the sound of their voices, that you can tell that sound, that accent is going. And we've recorded people who have died soon thereafter. We continue to keep their stories in rotation. You know, I have to go back and retrack it, and I say the late whoever it was. But bit by bit, over the years, we're developing this kind of community oral history of people describing the place we live. That's what they're all really about. They're all, we all live in this place together. We're all neighbors, and here's another one of us.
So has your listening changed? I mean, do you actually listen to radio a lot?
Well, I do, because we've got these little public radio stations that I started, and I really love listening to them. And I love it when they do something wonderful, when the, you know, one of the when there's a moment on that station that's thrilling. It's thrilling to me. There was a rare bird, for instance, out on Martha's Vineyard, and our local bird guy called in on the cell phone in the middle of morning edition and said, "I'm on my way. You know, there hasn't been a falcon like this here ever in my experience." Wait, and he was yelling at other drivers, and it was all in the air, and the thrill he had, and the host trying to, you know, moderate it, completely unexpected, happening in the instant. And, you know, for that, I would listen to the radio.
Well, Jay Allison, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jay Allison co-created the revived version of This I Believe and co-edited the new companion book. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, and this is NPR National Public Radio. Coming up, Stephen Frears talks about directing his new film, The Queen, about Queen Elizabeth and Tony Blair in the week following the death of Princess Diana. Frears also directed My Beautiful Laundrette, The Grifters, High Fidelity, and Dirty Pretty Things.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start October 2nd at capella.edu. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Bob and Mary Montgomery, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Stephen Frears, directed the films My Beautiful Laundrette, Prick Up Your Ears, The Grifters, High Fidelity, Dirty Pretty Things, and Mrs. Henderson Presents. His new film, The Queen, reflects on the place of the monarchy in contemporary England in an era when the public and the media are obsessed with celebrity. The film is set in the week following the death of Princess Diana, when thousands of people have gathered in front of the palace to mourn her. But the Queen insists on trying to keep the death a quiet family affair and withdraws from the public. The new Prime Minister, Tony Blair, sees the public response and tries to convince the Queen she needs to emerge and acknowledge the public's grief. The Queen is played by Helen Mirren, Blair by Michael Sheen. Sheen also played Blair in a film Frears made for British television. In this scene from The Queen, Blair calls the Queen after Diana's death.
Good morning, Your Majesty.
May I say right away how very sorry I am?
Thank you.
Is it your intention to make some kind of appearance or statement?
No, certainly not. No member of the royal family will speak publicly about this. This is a private matter.
I don't suppose anyone's had time to think about the funeral yet.
We've spoken with the Spencer family, and it is their express wish that this should be a private funeral.
Right.
And the public, then?
The British people?
You don't think a private funeral might be denying them a chance?
A chance to what? This is a family funeral, Mr. Blair, not a fairground attraction. I think the Princess has already paid a high enough price for exposure to the press, don't you? Now, if there's nothing else, I must get on. The children have to be looked after.
Of course.
Well, goodbye, Your Majesty.
Stephen Frears, welcome back to Fresh Air. What interested you in the angle of this movie?
Well, it was the idea of writing a film about the Queen. I mean, no one's ever made a film about the Queen.
Is that
so
right?
So it was very, very... No. It's me, no. Absolutely shocking thing to suggest. So in that sense, it was incredibly interesting.
Why is it shocking to even suggest it?
Because she's the Queen. She's my Queen. She's not your Queen. I can see you got rid of her, but she's my Queen.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I think Americans don't really quite understand the place of the Queen in English society.
Well, it is very, very hard to explain because it is so contradictory to the notion of democracy. No, we're governed, we're ruled by the... I'm not a citizen, I'm a subject, which is very, very galling and humiliating. You have a head start on me. But we're ruled over by this family in this extraordinary way. How much power they have is more complicated.
Now, when the film begins, Tony Blair has just been elected prime minister.
Yes.
And he goes to meet the Queen. And yes. He wants his government to be very informal. He is the Queen's 10th prime minister. Her first was Churchill. And their styles are completely opposite. She is very...
Well, he was...
Go ahead.
He was elected on a very modernizing platform. You know, he came in saying he was going to change everything, which Britain needed at the time. And he was enormously popular, won a huge majority, and was thought to be in touch with the people.
So he comes in as like popular figure, in touch with the people, call me Tony, very informal. Mm. And the Queen is, of course, all about emotional reserve and traditional formality.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, they're in a couple of scenes together, but mostly the Blair scenes and the Queen scenes are separate. And
yes.
It's almost as if you're making two different movies, shot in different
styles,
with different... It's like two completely different styles of filmmaking. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, the royal family that week were up in their house in Scotland. Well, their house in Scotland is like sort of fairyland. It's very, very remote, rather sort of old-fashioned, rather Germanic, you know, very like Disneyland, big towers on the buildings and things like that. They were completely cut off. So, yes, we did shoot it in a different style to illustrate their sort of isolation.
So are there things that you did in terms of the filmmaking to shoot the Queen's scenes and the Tony Blair scenes differently?
Yes, I shot the Tony Blair on 16mm and I shot the Queen on 35.
What's the difference between the two and why did you do that?
Well, 16mm, which I don't think you use a lot in this country, but in my country it's much more sort of demotic. Most of television is shot on 16mm, or it was shot on 16mm. 35mm is a much more beautiful, you know, image that you associate much more with Hollywood movies. So it was really to demonstrate the difference between the two worlds.
You know, I think one of the questions the film asks is, like, what's the role of the royal family in an era of celebrity. I mean, the royals were like the celebrities in a way, but now we have TV and we have movie stars to gossip about, celebrities have kind of like replaced the royal family in some ways.
And I'm slightly I thought you were going to ask me what the role of the royal family was in a democracy. Apart from the Queen, the children are all treated like celebrities. Diana was treated like a celebrity, and they fit effortlessly into celebrity. But it's their role in democracy that is eccentric and peculiar.
Well, do they have a role in the democracy? I thought their role was to be celebrities, you know, but to be a different kind of celebrity than...
Well, that's right, but of course the Queen doesn't like that. Uh-huh. She resists that. She's never given an interview in her life.
Never? Wow.
No. No.
So is there an official role for the royal family in a democracy?
Only in the most peculiar and complicated and British sort of way. It is most mysterious how it all works. Of course, the events of the film, that's the only time really in my life when the Queen's ever been criticised and appeared to get something wrong and to misjudge the mood of the country. Normally, she gets it right and is praised for that.
She was criticised for withdrawing the family for private grief as opposed to joining with the public
in sharing their grief. For not realising what the public wanted, that the public wanted something more demonstrative and the Queen wasn't capable of doing it or didn't at first want to do it and was very reluctant.
Now, Helen Mirren is incredible
as
the Queen your movie, The Queen. She's an unlikely choice in some senses and a perfect choice in others. I mean, she already played the first Queen Elizabeth. Mm. At the same time, she's also famous for her roles as sexually kinky women.
Sexy women, yes.
Yeah. I mean, and two of the movies I can think of are The Cook, The Thief, Her Wife and His Lover, and also Paul Schrader's film, The Comfort of Strangers.
Yes.
So tell me about casting her.
Well, Helen wasn't my idea. She was really the producer's idea. He also produces Prime Suspect. And I think he said that one day, sitting in a reading for Prime Suspect, he thought that Helen, in a certain light and from a certain angle, looked like the Queen. So he came to me and said, would I be interested in making a second film about Tony Blair, this time about these events, and with Helen playing the Queen. So Helen and I met, and I thought she'd be very good. I can't pretend I gave it a lot of thought. She just seemed a very good idea.
Are there things you told her about what you wanted from her in the role?
No. If you're British, you know, the Queen has been in my life for 60 years. So I don't really have to talk about her a lot. The Queen will have been in Helen's life for more or less the same amount of time. You know, she's absolutely part of our national psyche. I mean, I guess you don't have anybody like that in America because you don't have a permanent head of state. But she's, you know, if you post a letter in Britain, there's a picture of the Queen on it. So she just is part of our lives. So we start from a sort of common basis of an enormous amount of knowledge. You know, we know a lot about the Queen. At the same time, of course, we know nothing about the Queen. So there wasn't really one of those sort of conversations that you can imagine.
My guest is film director Stephen Frears. His new film is called The Queen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Frears, and he directed the new film, The Queen. You've directed so many different kinds of films. You know, there was My Beautiful Laundrette about a Pakistani immigrant in England who's gay. There's Prick Up Your Ears about the playwright Joe Orton. Mm. And, you know, jumping ahead to more recently, we have High Fidelity about a used record store owner.
Yes.
Dirty Pretty Things about illegal immigrants in England living in this kind of world in which they try to stay invisible. And that's a thriller, and so I'm leaving out a lot of films in between. But I mean, there's such a great contrast between The Queen and High Fidelity. You know, between like, you know, the Queen's.
Maybe Jack Black should have played the Queen.
Yeah, the Queen's palace and like the used record store that High Fidelity is set in. High Fidelity is based on a novel by Nick Hornby, and in the movie, John Cusack plays the owner of a used record store who always makes top 10 lists. Not only of his favorite records, but even of like his top 10 worst breakups and top 10 best girlfriends. They're really top fives. I always call them top 10s because I always think of top 10s. But so what was your connection to that material?
To High Fidelity?
Yeah.
Well, of course, it was originally a British novel. And I guess I understand that. And John Cusack, I directed in The Grifters. There was nothing. I mean, oddly, well, I suppose the only thing I didn't particularly understand was the music, but I understood the book, the rest, everything else about the book. And once I'd got over the shock of transferring it from to the US from London, which didn't take long. As soon as I read the script, I realized that London was less important than I'd imagined. No, I felt very, very at home with it, and also everybody else on the set was sort of world experts on music. So it was, I think, quite a relief. It was quite helpful that I knew nothing about music. I could judge everything from sort of different values and protect the film in some way.
One of the things that I really like about the adaptation is, first of all, you preserve the voice of the writer Nick Hornby by doing a lot of voiceovers.
Yes.
And
yes.
In fact,
that seemed very, very important.
Let's stop there for a second and play one of the voiceovers from the movie. And this is John Cusack, the used record store owner.
I own this store called Championship Vinyl. It's located in a neighborhood that attracts the bare minimum of window shoppers.
I get by because the people make a special effort to shop here. Mostly young men who spend all their time looking for deleted Smith singles and original, not re-released underline, Frank Zappa albums.
That's John Cusack in a scene from High Fidelity, which was directed by my guest, Stephen Frears. How is it difficult to direct convincing voiceovers like that in a movie in which we're actually seeing the characters talking to us? He's on camera talking to us.
Yes, in fact, we changed it. It was when I originally read the American script, it was voiceover, and we changed it to direct address because I thought it was so important. It was always clear to me that the book meant a lot to people. You know, that young people really cared about the book, and that you had to treat the book with tremendous respect. And one of the things that pleased me about the script that I read that was set in Chicago was that it showed you a way to get to the important bits of the book. And the important bits of the book are, in fact, unspoken thoughts. They're John Cusack's thoughts, really. So we were really always trying to find devices that would enable us to use the passages, these brilliant passages in Nick Hornby's book, which described the character's, you know, the inside of his head.
And something else I thought you really got right in the movie adaptation is the record store really looks like a used record store, and John Cusack's apartment is perfect. It's all kind of like sagging record shelves. You know, it's not one of these like TV sitcom apartments with a great big kitchen and a lovely living room. It's all record shelves.
Well, I know what it's like to have been a depressed young man. So I guess you start from that. You're really only saying, well, you did your job well. You know, that was the job, to get that right. If you'd got that wrong, you wouldn't have made half as good a film.
Well, that's the point. You got your it right.
But there were people who would have, yes, but that's what I'm paid to do, is get it right. I mean, that's what I celebrate, really.
Right.
But there were people around, you know. I mean, if it had somehow looked the way you described, like something out of a sitcom, you know, John would have told me. I mean, people would have queued up to say how wrong we were. So we had a lot of experts on the set.
When you started to make movies, let's see, what year was that approximately?
I made my first film in 1967 and my first full-length film in 1970.
Okay, so what was going on then in the part of British film culture that you were most interested in?
It was about to be a rather poor time in British cinema. There was a very, very good time towards the end of the 50s and early 60s. Then it all became about music. The Beatles came, the Stones came. And music really took over from the movies. And all through the 70s, it was a very, very dull time in British cinema. We were all working in British television, which is where the good films were actually being made. And then it resurfaced again in the middle of the 80s when I made, well, the film that did it, I suppose. There were various things happened. There were all the films out of Goldcrest, Chariots of Fire, and then I made My Beautiful Laundrette. But that particular time, what I really remember about it is that the Americans left London. In other words, there are various periods when the American studios have offices in London and make films out of London. And then I guess when they start to lose money or the subject matter starts to run dry, the Americans go somewhere else. I'm sorry, I don't mean to sound anti-American.
So what was it about British television that made it a good place to be making movies in the 70s?
Well, we weren't really making movies. We were making films, and it was just a very, very creative period. Television was quite new in Britain, and it was just where all the forward-thinking people were working. So when I was making films in the 70s, they were being written by the best writers in the country. They had the best actors in the country, and it was a sort of wonderful time to be working there. There was no commercial obligations at all. You simply made them, and they went out. People were interested in them because, of course, there was a new subject, which was really the new Britain that was emerging.
Yeah, and the new Britain that was emerging, that's something that you really got in My Beautiful Laundrette.
Well, yes, that was, of course, later. No, I really mean the Britain that produced it, really, you know, the climax in the Beatles, really.
Oh, that Beatles, new Britain.
Yes, that new Britain. Well, the Beatles were the product of huge social changes which were tied up with the war.
Yeah, so how did you get to that in your movies? Like, how did you connect to those changes?
Well, I became one of the filmmakers who were making films about, not about the sort of traditional view of Britain, but about what it was like to be British at that particular moment, having experienced all those changes.
And what?
I mean, in a way, My Beautiful Laundrette was what it was like to be British in the middle of the 1980s,
right?
And to have had that sort of legacy of empire.
Just getting back to the 70s for a second, what did the Beatles mean in your life? I mean, you're much deeper into film than into music, but did you feel the change either musically or culturally? Yeah, can you talk about that a little?
There was a huge social change. I mean, basically, before the war, there was no working class culture. It simply didn't exist. And then because of the war, there were changes in things like education. So suddenly young working class people were being educated properly. And they started appearing. They started writing books, and they started making films, and they started making music. And eventually, they turned into the Beatles.
And
the Beatles before the war wouldn't have existed.
I guess that also opened the door to making movies and music about working class people.
Yes, that was really the big change that had happened.
Now, My Beautiful Laundrette, which was what year is it? It's 86 or something.
85, 86, yeah.
Yeah. So that's. A film set in the Margaret Thatcher era.
Yes.
And it's about being a new immigrant from Pakistan and being gay at the same time.
Yes. It's really about, the immigrants were people who, you know, they were the children of empire, really. The writer, Hanif Qureshi, was born in England and was brought up, you know, went to an English school, grew up with English kids. So that was what was really striking about it. It was the first time it was written from sort of inside.
Now, you more recently did a movie about immigrants in London, and this was about illegal immigrants.
Yes, and also not people to do with the empire. These were people from Turkey and Russia and Spain and places. I mean, nothing to do with the legacy of having had an empire. Empires are catastrophic things.
And what interested you in Dirty Pretty Things, the film about the illegal
immigrants? Because
immigrants?
It made sense, like The Laundrette, it made sense of what I could see when I walked down the street and didn't understand. In other words, you started noticing that London was full of foreigners, And then suddenly there was a script that explained who they were and what they were doing there. Just as in the laundrette, you know, the things that were around us, the newsagents, the grocers, all those sort of shops were run by Asians. And suddenly someone wrote a script which explained them and explained a lot of things that nobody had understood before. And the same with Dirty Pretty Things. It made sense of what it was like to walk down the street.
Now, of course, in Dirty Pretty Things, it's not like a documentary about immigrants. It's a mystery. It's a pretty hard-boiled film noirish kind of thing about the underground economy in human organs.
Mm. Well, of course, by then I'd been to Hollywood and I'd learnt these corrupt habits. And what I always liked about the script was that it treated people as if they were in an American film, so that in the end, these young, attractive immigrants sort of win. It wasn't like a normal pattern of a British film where you would treat people like that as victims. They would much more like the stars of an American film.
That's an interesting way of looking at it.
Mm. Well, I was very struck by that immediately and always liked it. I loved the fact that they won.
Stephen Frears directed the new film, The Queen. This is Fresh Air. Whether we're talking about movies or the issues of the day, one of the things that makes public radio stand out is time. We can take the time to consider the subject in depth, time to explain, time to reflect, and not be constantly interrupted by commercial breaks. Your support makes all this possible. Your station is fundraising today. Please call with a pledge. Thank you. My guest is film director Stephen Frears. His films include My Beautiful Laundrette, The Grifters, High Fidelity, and Dirty Pretty Things. His new film is The Queen. Now, when you started your movie career, you first were an assistant to Lindsay Anderson, who's most famous for the movie If, and then Carol Rice, who's most famous in the U.S. for his movie The French Lieutenant's Woman. What are some of the things you learned from working with them?
Well, they were both extraordinary men, and they taught me, I mean, not just about films, they taught me about life. But if you were to ask what the lesson was, it was that there was a connection between the cinema and life, and maybe that's slightly gone away now. You know, I learnt how to live, really, from the cinema, you know, or how to kiss girls, things like that. You learn large bit, you know, our lives in Britain were so narrow, were so unimaginative, and the world, I learned about the world and growing up and things like that from films, because there wasn't anywhere else to learn them.
Now, which films taught you about, say, how to kiss a girl?
Oh, every high school film that was made in the 50s. I mean, not ones that were particularly famous, but, you know, just the whole introduction of American culture. I mean, I can remember first hearing Elvis. It was just astonishing to sit in England and hear these extraordinary people from the South. I didn't know the South existed in those days. We're a small island. We were so cut off from everything. And it was quite a hard time because of the war. So suddenly you were introduced to these very, very colourful alternative ways of living.
One of the things you've done in your career is discover some really interesting actors.
Yes, fantastic.
In High Fidelity, you have Jack Black and also Todd Luizzo, who's starting to become, I think, a little better known now. He played
one
of the guys in the record
store. Wonderful man.
Yeah, he's really good.
I mean, the truth is, I had no idea that Jack was going to act the way he did. You know, I thought he'd be good in the film, but I didn't know that what was about to emerge. So, you know, I could see I was the sort of midwife, and I must in some way have given him room to do that. I asked him afterwards why that had happened. And he said he'd always kept his head down, and suddenly someone said, well, why don't you stick your head up? But I wasn't really aware of what I was doing. I must have somehow made it comfortable for him to do that.
Well, why did you cast him? What did you see in him?
Well, the boys, you know, I was working with these three boys from Chicago. I said, who should play this part? And they just said Jack Black, without any doubt. And then when I was casting it, I met other people, but I never found anyone I thought would be as good as Jack. But that doesn't mean I knew what Jack was going to do. I hadn't seen Tenacious D and all that stuff he does. I just remember the first day that he shot, him starting, and I was just amazed. And then very, very soon realized that what he was doing was absolutely phenomenal and I should just be grateful and shut up.
One more question about the Queen.
Yeah.
Did you run into any resistance in making the Queen, resistance to having a movie about the Queen or about Tony Blair?
No, the palace are above these things. They neither approve nor disapprove. To take a position would be political, and they're, in that sense, non-political. I mean, there were a few people who owned castles in Scotland who, you know, thought it was somehow improper, but that just meant we had to look more carefully and be more imaginative. So, no, we ran into no trouble.
So now that you've made the Queen, are you hoping that one day you will be knighted by the Queen?
I don't expect to be knighted.
Well, this might be your thing here.
No. I say what Peter O'Toole says. I only accept awards from republics. That's a whole separate issue, the honours system. I mean, that's...
Would you actually reject an award like that?
I'd probably be rather pleased to be offered it, but my wife would leave me.
Would she really?
I think so, yes.
So she's really opposed to the monarchy?
She's opposed to the privilege. It's really to do with privilege. And, you know, quite rightly, she's opposed to it. And I'd rather have my wife than an honour.
So she would try to convince you to decline?
She wouldn't try to. She'd succeed effortlessly with one blow of her handbag.
Well, Stephen Frears, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Frears directed the new film, The Queen. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Jack Black from the soundtrack of High Fidelity.
I've been really trying, baby, trying to hold on to this feeling for so long. And if you feel like I feel, sugar, come on.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Forrest Whitaker. He plays the Ugandan dictator Idi Amin in the new film, The Last King of Scotland. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.